Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Kyle Mabry is at the controls this morning. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking, at least in part, about banking reform and try to talk a little bit about what the federal government has done so far to try to help some of the country's large financial institutions that were in danger of failing, and perhaps also talk a little bit about what might be changed to try to prevent those kinds of big failures in the future. And our guest for the program is George Panaki. He's professor of finance here at the University of Illinois. He's also co-director of the Office for Banking Research. He's a research associate at the Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland and also program coordinator for deposit insurance at the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation's Center for Financial Research. And we'll try to talk about a number of things this morning, again, as I said, about the government and how it's responded to the current financial crisis. And questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. So if you're listening over the air around Illinois and Indiana, or you might happen to be listening on the internet, either way, the toll-free line is 800-222-9455. So locally, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Thanks very much for being here.
You're welcome.
I appreciate it. I wonder if we could sort of review, talk a little bit about where we are now. Obviously, going back to last fall, we had a number of very large financial institutions that were in big trouble for reasons people, I think, probably know about or we can talk about, that the government made the determination that to allow them to fail would have widespread negative consequences in the economy. So the decision was made, no, we can't let that happen. At the beginning, it was a little piecemeal. It was a little rocky where they were deciding exactly what they were going to do and then finally settled on an approach. And I guess there are still some questions about whether that approach is the right one. Initially, the idea was we're going to set aside a big pot of money and we were going to buy up bad assets. And then we shifted to say, well, maybe the thing to do was these institutions, they need capital. So what we're going to do is instead we're going to actually take a position. We're going to put money in these big institutions. We're going to get stock in exchange and we're going to do that. And we've been doing that and have spent a lot of money doing that. We still got toxic assets we had to deal with. So we still have some very serious problems. And I guess I'm interested in, you know, generally your thoughts about the approach that and mostly I guess we're talking about the approach of the previous administration and then the previous Secretary of the Treasury to try to meet this crisis.
Right. Well, as you summarized there, we know that the initial approach was to try to take some of these mortgage-related assets, which were hard to value, so-called toxic assets, and get them off the bank's balance sheet or at least create a market for them so that we could better value them, come up with more objective prices. This was the main goal of the $700 billion TARP, the Troubled Asset Relief Program that Secretary Paulson was selling at the time to Congress. They changed course very quickly after approval of the program. In part, at least the rationale was that they needed to act more quickly than would be possible if they had set up these auctions to buy back the assets. And so what the program morphed into was a program where they would inject capital into the largest banks, primarily the largest banks, in return for obtaining preferred stock in those institutions. So as of now, we have in the range of somewhat over 200 financial institutions that have received TARP funding, and the total amount of capital injected into these institutions is close to $200 billion. Mm-hmm. And now we're at a phase, and the Obama administration is now considering actually going back to the original idea of the Paulson plan to try to get these assets off the bank's balance sheet. And one proposal is to create a so-called bad bank or aggregator bank, which would purchase the assets from the banks and then create this government-managed financial institution that would hold these assets and eventually either sell them off or hold them till maturity until they receive payments from the mortgage borrowers. So that's sort of where we stand now. The injection of capital has not been totally successful. It's reduced the likelihood of banks failing, but it has not generated private capital and private borrowing into banks. So we still have somewhat of a credit freeze. By getting these hard-to-value assets off the bank's balance sheet, it would create more trust by investors so that they would be willing to lend to banks so that banks could then lend this money to consumers and businesses.
Mm. Well, certainly there's been a lot of criticism of the institutions that have received TARP funds. People have said, look, the idea was that we were going to give you this money and then you're supposed to start lending again to free up credit. And that, in fact, these banks, they haven't done that. What they've been doing is they've been either holding it, they've been paying out bonuses to employees. Do you think that kind of criticism that's been leveled at the institutions that have gotten the money has been justified?
Well, yes and no. From a bank's point of view, it is in survival mode for at least many large institutions. And they can't obtain borrowing from the private market to fund their loans. Pretty much right now, they're trying to just survive. And it's hard to distinguish between a decline in the demand for borrowing, which naturally occurs during a recession such as we're experiencing now, and banks cutting back on their lending. As a manager of a bank, one would think this is probably a bad time to be making loans in terms of credit risk has gone up across the board. There are still many, many banks, maybe not the largest of banks, but many banks that are providing loans to creditworthy borrowers. But relative to 2 years ago, when pretty much anyone who walked into a bank could get a loan, we're certainly going to see a reduction in lending. We're probably not going to go back to a world, at least in the near future, where credit was so easy. So naturally, we would see a cut back in lending. Mm.
When Congress agreed to set aside the $700 billion for the TARP, the Troubled Asset Relief Program, initially they said, well, what we want to do is we don't want to give out all that money all at once. We'll give you some of it and see how that goes. And now the Obama administration has said, we need the rest of that money. And as you said, they are talking about this shift in a sense, although maybe it's going back to the original idea about buying up the bad assets. I think that there are some people, though, who also make this argument that the banks, the big financial institutions, they actually still need more money. There still needs to be more recapitalization and that money's got to come from somewhere. And so I think people are starting to say, well, that $700 billion to do what needs to be done in terms of both recapitalization and if you're going to try to do something with the toxic assets, is $700 billion going to be enough?
Part of that $700 billion, if it is indeed used to create this so-called bad bank or aggregator bank, would be used to capitalize this this bank to begin with. The main issue with using TARP money to get these bad assets off of banks is exactly what price is the aggregator bank or the, essentially the government going to buy these assets? And the FDIC chair, Sheila Bair, has stated that the government would buy them at their fair market value. But the big issue is exactly what is the fair market value, because these assets are so difficult to assess in terms of what their future repayments are going to be. That's the nature of this toxic asset name. So that's going to be the difficulty. If the government purchases them at a very low price, then taxpayers could indeed face greater losses, and we may need more TARP money to set up this type of program. If they purchase them at too high a price, well, maybe the banks don't want to buy them or sell them at those prices, and we may not have a very successful way of getting these bad assets off the bank. Now, another part of the additional TARP money is going to be used to attempt to help directly homeowners that are facing possible foreclosure. So the Obama administration has emphasized that point, which is somewhat different from what the previous administration. So how much money is going to be, siphoned off into that part that won't be available directly for financial institutions? We really don't know at this point.
Yeah. We have some callers here, and let me again introduce our guest, George Panaki. He is professor of finance here at the University of Illinois in the College of Business. He's co-director of the Office for Banking Research. He's also research associate at the Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland. We're talking here about the current financial crisis, how the government has responded, what's likely to happen in the future. Perhaps also try to talk a little bit about the idea of regulation and what might be done to try to prevent this kind of thing from happening again in the future. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. We'll start with a caller in Indiana, Bloomington, Indiana, on our toll-free line. That's line four. Hello.
Hi. This idea of troubled banks splitting into bad bank and good bank, I think this is just what Citigroup has done, isn't it? Citigroup has just announced they're going to do that.
It's a bit different what Citigroup has announced. They are going to split into two divisions, one which is Citicorp, which is going to hold the traditional bank assets. So as we typically think of what a bank does, it issues deposits and makes loans. That's pretty much what Citicorp is going to be. The other division of Citigroup is going to be called City Holdings, and that's going to be a division that is doing pretty much non-traditional banking activities, such as underwriting securities and investment banking, sales and trading activities. So it's not that they're going to split off their bad mortgage-related assets into a bad bank versus a good bank. There's the good and bad assets, at least as of now, are still going to be within Citicorp.
Uh-huh.
However, one rescue package that has been put together by the Treasury and the FDIC for Citigroup is that already the government is going to be guaranteeing several hundred billion dollars of mortgage-related assets for Citigroup. So currently taxpayers already are on the hook to insure the bad assets of Citigroup.
So so the bad assets, the troubled assets, will not will not be centered either in Citi Holdings or Citicorp. Is that correct?
Well, they'll be in Citicorp.
I see.
But they essentially also have a government guarantee that will minimize the losses to Citicorp. Any losses of above a particular level, I think it might be a 40. I think it's a $300 billion portfolio of troubled assets. And after the first $42 billion of losses, then the Treasury and the FDIC will absorb the rest of the losses. So what's happened is the government essentially is insuring against any catastrophic losses on Citicorp's bad loans.
And that should increase public confidence in Citicorp so that people can rest assured that they can do business with Citicorp and this, their deposits and their business that they do with Citicorp will not be lost. It will not be lost money. They're pretty much guaranteed. At least they'll get their principal back. Is that right?
Well, it certainly has helped stabilize Citicorp to some extent, Citigroup to some extent.
And otherwise, they wouldn't be willing to do business with Citicorp because right now they think it might go bankrupt.
Well, that's right. That's right. The rescue package occurred last fall. And actually, another bank, Bank of America, has just received a similar rescue package from the U.S. Treasury. Bank of America was a fairly healthy bank, but last December they acquired Merrill Lynch.
Yeah.
And Merrill Lynch turned out to have more losses than first thought, and Bank of America was going to back out of the deal. Yes, go ahead.
And the bad bank, good bank scheme is intended to increase public confidence. Is that the main, that's the main reason, that's the main goal?
Right. The good bank, bad bank scheme, actually, I think the first good example of that, in the, at least in the U.S., was during the late 80s when Mellon Bank, which was a Pittsburgh bank, split into a good bank and a bad bank. They did this without any government intervention. And the idea is that put all your hard-to-value toxic assets in a separate division and then have a good bank where investors can easily evaluate what your bank is worth. And if indeed your bank has positive value after you've taken all out these bad assets, then investors are going to be more willing to provide funding for that bank.
Thank you very much.
No, thanks. Well, I think, though, the question, the columnist's questions maybe invite this question. Do we really need to have the government set up a bad bank to round up and contain all the toxic assets? Or should we say to the financial institutions that have them, say, you do this. You can do this for yourself. Make your own good and bad banks and leave the government out of it.
Well, I think one concern might be that if the banks did it themselves, they may indeed be insolvent, that there could well be many banks that if they replaced their toxic assets, the value of those toxic assets would be just too low, so that the good bank would be left with capital or net worth, which would just be below regulatory standards. And in addition, perhaps the incentive now is that if the government is going to step in with help, why should we do it ourselves? Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, originally, we had proposals at the very start of this financial crisis for banks to privately create a so-called super SIV, which was a structured investment vehicle that would hold a lot of bad mortgage-related assets. And that actually fell through, perhaps in part because government assistance was expected. So I think there's a lot of distortions that often occur when we have the possibility of a taxpayer assistance or taxpayer bailout, and perhaps some private market solutions are not being implemented because we're looking for at least the bankers are looking for a more lucrative solution with government help.
Yeah. Let's take some other callers. Next, Champagne Line 1. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Good morning. I have a question. Maybe this will expose my ignorance. I can't for the life of me figure out why. If the banks need capital, after all, if I need capital and I have to go borrow it, I have to pay a certain interest rate. If the banks need capital, why don't they make it worthwhile to me to deposit my money with them? Why don't they have CDs or interest rates attached to accounts that are that make me want to go deposit with them? I think there's a lot of people out here with a lot of money, which they're not quite sure what to do with. Why shouldn't they have to pay me a good rate to deposit my money with them if they need my capital?
Okay, well, that's a great question. The attractiveness of investing in a bank, say through a deposit like a CD, is in part going to be related to whether that deposit is insured or not. I think people are very ready to invest in a bank if they know that the FDIC is going to be insuring that deposit. But while the FDIC has liberalized the conditions under which deposits are insured this past fall as part of the TARP legislation, deposit insurance limits were raised from $100,000 to $250,000 per account. And we now actually are allowing banks to insure non-interest checking accounts to an unlimited amount in return for them paying 10 cents per $100 of their checking account deposits. So there are insured deposits that banks can issue, but that's limited. We don't have currently unlimited amounts of deposit insurance. So the next source of funding that banks have to look toward is uninsured deposits and uninsured debt. And there's limitations on what an investor is willing to obtain. The fact that an investor might lose if these banks fail puts a damper on the willingness to lend money to banks, and that's the problem now. Even other banks are not willing to lend to particular banks because of fear that if the bank fails, they'll experience a loss. They won't not only get their high promised interest rate back, but they won't even get their principal
back. You know, if I've got $400,000, I can take that and split that up. I can make sure that it is going to an FDIC-insured, you know, whatever.
That's right.
And when you go to your bank and you find out that the CD rate is the same thing as the very low rate they're paying to their best accounts, it seems to me like they don't want my money very badly. And if the word is capital, I still don't understand.
Okay. Well, there's a difference between the debt of a bank and capital. Another name for the capital of the bank is the shareholder's equity. And banks cannot just keep growing by issuing deposits. And they compete with other banks to issue deposits. And if the deposit interest rate is too high for them, it's going to be hard for them to make a profit or break even on their loans, especially during an economic downturn when the likelihood of loan defaults is high. So there's a slippery slope that banks face. They can't pay too high deposit insurance rates. They can't fund everything with deposits because then they go below their minimum regulatory capital ratios, which is the ratio of their equity to their debt and deposits. So while in principle, you know, banks could obtain more deposits, it would be at a cost that might make lending unprofitable, and it may further put them in trouble with regulators.
Okay, thank you.
All right, let's go to Champaign Line 2. Hello.
Morning.
Yes.
I wonder if I outline the situation, I wonder if you could tell me how I'm wrong, either factually or at least incorrect ideologically. Like, to my mind, this bank bailout is that these banks would go out of business if we didn't bail them out. Such it's like welfare to the shareholders. Why not let them go down and then buy them, and we're buying them anyway, and own them? But why is it a good deal for the taxpayer to bail out these shareholders? I mean, I don't understand that. Of course, you realize that the Swedes did do that, right?
Yeah.
And then what's your view?
Right. Well, in fact, it is not a good deal for the taxpayers. The rationale for the government stepping in to bail out large financial institutions is that the failure of one large institution might create losses for other financial institutions that do business with that failed institution, and that there would be a domino effect.
Can I interject? I'll accept that as true, but why not, when you bail them out, why not just buy them out and own them and like let the shareholders go to law? I mean, you'd still control them that way, right? And you'd have equity, which I thought was one of those things we strove for.
Well, unlike the case of Sweden, where there were just a few large banks, we have a large number of big financial institutions in the United States. And the job of government managing these several large financial institutions would be just extremely difficult. I think there's the belief that, yes, we could take over, as in the case of, say, Continental Illinois, when that failed in the 1980s. We took over that large bank and ran it temporarily, but as soon as was practicable, they reprivatized the bank. Why? It's just probably not a good idea to have government trying to manage a large part of the financial system. Even Lawrence Summers, one of the chief economists in the Obama administration, commented recently that if they do take over banks, they'd like to return them to private hands relatively soon.
Okay. We continue to disagree about how we view things.
Well, I guess it's just a very difficult task to run these.
Well, you're really not addressing the question about why wouldn't, you know, they could still manage the money if they wish to, or if we wish to have them do that. But why wouldn't the American taxpayer do better to have an equity stake instead of just bankrolling them? I mean, they're essentially out of business if we don't give them the money. So why do we own them? Why don't we own them?
Well, we do own a large part of many of the financial institutions. We have preferred stock positions in these financial institutions, and if the losses continue to mount, there will be a possible scenario where we will own those institutions.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Well, in fact, this was something that I wanted to raise. I think that there are some people who are saying that some institutions are going to require such a large infusion of capital that the United States government, it was going to end up with a majority stake in them. Now, that's not exactly the same as taking over the bank. The government's not going to run the bank. But there are some people who would say, well, that's nationalization of a fashion if you're the majority shareholder.
I agree. I mean, it's not a black-white issue that there is this gray area where regulators do own, for in the case of say Citigroup, a large part of that institution, and I think they're to some extent influencing Citigroup's activities. They're in some ways pressuring them to split off some of these non-bank divisions, and they're also pressuring Citigroup to perhaps go along with some government policies, such as allowing bankruptcy judges to change the clauses of mortgage agreements to reduce the possibility of foreclosure. Interestingly, Citigroup was one of the few large banks that came out in favor of this policy. So I think Citigroup realizes that they're under the thumb of a lot of government pressure. And so already I think there's signs that they are being indirectly managed by the government.
And I think that's interesting because it was certainly my understanding that most of the industry was opposed to the idea of giving bankruptcy judges that power to renegotiate the terms of mortgages. They didn't want to do it.
Right, right. And I think Citigroup is one of the outliers in that, and maybe for good reason.
Well, just real quick, it sounded like in part that you were agreeing with the caller in the sense that you were saying, you know, the caller said this is a bad deal for taxpayers, and you said, yeah, actually, you also think it's a bad deal for taxpayers. But is what you're saying or what you would say is that things are so bad that even though maybe this isn't a great deal, it's just something that has to be done? Or would you argue for some fundamentally different approach?
I'm sympathetic to the approaches that we're attempting to implement now to get the financial system back on track. My focus, though, is to try to prevent the next financial crisis. The regulatory system needs to be changed. It's flawed in the sense that it makes it very likely that there will be a taxpayer bailout. And if we don't change the regulatory system, we'll have more taxpayer bailouts in the future. One main issue that needs to be addressed is to prevent what many people have referred to as the too big to fail argument for bailing out large financial institutions. This idea is what I alluded to earlier of a domino effect from one large financial institution's failure, that if a large bank like Bank of America, Citigroup, or Wells Fargo failed, it would lead to losses at other institutions. One of the primary justifications for bailing out these institutions is that if you don't do so, then the losses are going to spread throughout the economy. So what I certainly would support is ways to prevent trading relationships between banks to result in losses. There's currently an important reform that is likely to be implemented in the near future, which would reduce counterparty risk between large institutions. Many of these large banks provide derivative trading to their customers, and in many cases, these customers are other large financial institutions. And if a large bank fails, that could lead to trading losses in these derivative contracts at other financial institutions. One way to minimize that is to force the trading of derivative contracts to have collateral put up between the trading partners. And the way that could be managed is through a central clearinghouse, such as what occurs when derivative contracts are traded on an exchange such as the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. Indeed, the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, the CME Group, is now proposing a clearinghouse for so-called over-the-counter derivative contracts that would minimize the chance that a failure of one institution would result in losses in other institutions. So this would go a long way of removing the incentive to bail out large banks. If the loss of that bank would not impose losses in other financial institutions, then there would no longer be that justification to bail out the large bank. We would let it fail, the shareholders would take losses, and it would be reorganized just like a small bank is reorganized when it fails. Another way of reducing too big to fail would be to have regulators go through crisis drills, such as we now have government going through drills for terrorism events. Cities often go through what would they do if there was a terrorist attack. Well, similarly, regulators should examine a bank's activities and figure out just exactly if this bank became troubled, what would they do to resolve it without having losses spill over to other financial institutions. So these reforms were put in place actually or suggested several years ago, but unfortunately they were not implemented. And if they had, I think we could have avoided some of the big taxpayer bailouts that we're seeing today.
We're into the point here where we have about, 15 minutes left, and I have some callers I want to get to. But just to make sure that I understand what you're saying, or at least the implications of what you're saying, because I'm getting a little lost in the details, but it sounds as if what you're saying is that in the past, large financial institutions have engaged in risky behavior because they felt that if they really got into trouble, the federal government would be there to help them. And what you're saying is that things need to be structured in a way so that these institutions, they are bearing the risk. And if they do something risky and they get in trouble, then they're going to have to, in a sense, bail themselves out. Is that what I'm hearing?
Exactly. We have to put in place rules, so there would be no incentive for regulators to declare institutions too big to fail and help them. We need to reduce the complexity or the interconnectedness between institutions, and one way of doing that is through a clearinghouse where traders in different financial institutions have to put up collateral, so-called margin, that they would have at risk if they failed. And so it would not spread losses throughout the financial system.
And that's the other thing that I hear you saying is if we have financial institutions that are creating investment instruments that essentially are pieces of paper that they're passing back and forth, that somewhere there's got to be some kind of tangible asset that backs that, that says this is not just a piece of paper, it's worth something, and I can show you that indeed the collateral is really worth what I say that it's worth, because it seems to me that's the problem that we got into before with these bundled bad mortgages, is that we were assuming that they were worth something, and it turns out that they weren't.
Right. Yeah. One would need, as happens when there's trading on – say the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, to put up good quality collateral to support any risk that you're taking, such as a treasury bill, rather than a very hard to value asset.
Yeah. All right. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is George Panaki. He is professor of finance here at the U of I, co-director of the Office for Banking Research. And we're talking here about a little bit about banking reform and also about how it is that the government is dealing with the financial crisis that we're in right now. We have a number of callers. We'll try to get as many as we can in the time that remains. And we'll start in with somebody in Champaign, I believe, calling on a cell phone here, line 3. Hello.
Yes, hi. How are you?
Good.
I want to thank the professor so much, but, you know, this just brings up so many things to comment and question. You know, it disturbs me that we don't wipe out the common shareholders of these banks when we bail them out. I don't know if he has anything on that. Also, the question of regulators being so close to the banks. I know if he knows of the case not too long ago with the FAA regulators and some of the airlines, it was a major issue. And as far as redoing the mortgages, in many cases, wouldn't that just leave them failure 6 months to a year down the road? And my question is, I was looking at some information from the St. Louis Fed that showed that Citigroup, I think their liabilities were just amazingly amount for the amount of capital that they have. Thank you.
All right. We could probably go on for another hour.
Okay. In most cases, these financial institutions have had almost all their shareholders' equity wiped out. I think more of a concern is the uninsured debt holders. They've been even preserved, even though legally they're not required to have government protection. So, you know, I think your argument can go farther that we should not only wipe out the shareholders' equity, but, you know, perhaps even going a little farther down the line, that even the uninsured debt holders should be wiped out. And I think if we didn't have too big to fail, then that would probably be the right thing to do. But the fear is that allowing one institution to fail would wipe out some of the value in other financial institutions. But I agree that in an ideal world where you didn't have systemic risk, we should force the bank shareholders to suffer a loss for the risk that the bank took.
Well, just to pick out one other thing, I mean, what sort of requirements are there that banks have a certain amount of assets to balance off their liabilities? And have we in fact, is that spread wider than it should be?
There are minimum capital regulations. Indeed, it's not just a U.S. regulation. It's a worldwide regulation called the Basel Capital Accord. And the amount of excess assets over liabilities, what we think of as capital, the greater of the value of assets over liabilities, is a function of how risky those assets are, which is in principle the right thing to do. So that if a bank has many risky assets, it has to hold more asset value relative to its liabilities. We interestingly currently have less capital required for mortgages than other types of loans. Going into this crisis, mortgages in many banks had a capital requirement that was half those of other loans. And I think part of the problem was that investing in mortgage-related assets was attractive because it was viewed to be a low-risk investment. And unfortunately, many banks stocked up on those mortgage assets, which turned out to be much more risky than thought.
Yeah, because I suppose the deal was that people thought, well, it's secured by the property, and that we have this idea that property has this value, and that the values never go down.
Exactly, right.
They just always keep going
sure,
up.
Sure. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Well, what is there also an issue? You know, I guess one of the questions is who makes the if you're making a determination of risk, who makes that determination? And obviously, it seems that whoever was doing that fell down on the job, because the degree of risk was much higher than whoever was making the assessment was saying that it was.
Right. Well, I think there's a lot of blame to go around. One was an over-reliance on credit rating agencies. that many mortgage-backed assets were AAA rated, yet they were far more risky than most other AAA rated securities. The models that were being used were flawed in many ways, perhaps because they were using historical data to estimate mortgage defaults when we had for decades rising real estate prices and very few mortgage defaults. And this created maybe a sense of confidence that the likelihood of nationwide decline in real estate prices and mortgage defaults were just thought to be extremely unlikely. And then also loosening of mortgage standards. The subprime mortgage crisis was in part a result of too easy credit and too easy lending standards. And we didn't have much historical experience with those types of mortgages. So so the models turned out to be less accurate than thought.
Let's take a caller next in Belgium, line four. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. In the beginning of the program, Mr. Inge mentioned that this bank failures and economic problems started in October, September. Now, actually, our problems were manifested over in Europe and other places 6 months to a year earlier. And so they were really telling us what was going to happen in October. Now, in Europe and other parts of the world, there's even more troubles happening. This kind of tends to tell me that we're not going down the right track yet.
I think you can actually there was public recognition of a problem back in August of 2007. And that's when defaults on subprime mortgages started rising much higher than people expected. We then at first thought the problem was going to just be confined to subprime mortgages, but it spread. And I think one of the problems in Europe was that they had purchased many U.S. Subprime mortgage-backed securities, so that their problems initially seemed to be just related to U.S. assets, but then this has spread, and there's now, with the economic downturn, more credit risk that has become apparent not just in the mortgage market, but even in the corporate security market.
Yes, it seems, though, that the economy being so tied together, it's no longer just an American problem. It's no longer any just place. The whole thing is combined, and it's built on a house of cards. If something shakes in the bottom, the whole thing comes down.
Well, one benefit of a global financial system, which I think you're alluding to, is that there is the possibility that risks can be shared across countries. And in principle, that could be good. But when the risk was miscalculated to such a large extent as occurred with the mortgage market, then a problem in the U.S. can indeed be felt overseas. Now, if we had had all of the holdings of subprime mortgages just within the U.S., we may have had even a larger problem within our country than what we're experiencing now.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, thank you. We're coming to the point here where we're going to have to finish up our conversation because we've just come to the end of the time. What do you think now is likely to happen? What do you think that we're going to see, over the next 6-8 months? And are you with those people who say things are going to continue to get worse? Or maybe you just say, well, we don't really know we're just going to have to see where things are at about the middle of the year? What do you think?
Well, I think it's the latter, that I think it's very hard to forecast when this crisis, this recession will end. I think we're putting in a lot of short-term stopgap measures to try to get the economy and the financial system back on its feet. But the big challenge is to wean these financial institutions off of government support. I think a big issue is that once things do seem to improve, are we going to find a way of getting the taxpayer out of insuring so much of the financial system as it's as is happening now? And if we don't do that, then it's going to create the likelihood that a new crisis will occur, because institutions that are being insured by taxpayers have, unfortunately, an incentive to take on excessive risk.
Yeah. So here we've got a new administration. We've got new people in the positions, the financial oversight positions. What do you think the chances of actually something happening to change things in the direction that you're talking about?
Well, I think it's good. I think there's smart people that are trying to find solutions, and this idea of creating an aggregator bank, I think, is worthy of attempting. I think then, though, after this crisis is over, we can't just forget about it, that we need to put in place policies that will prevent the next one from happening.
All right. There we will have to leave it. With our thanks to our guest, George Panaki. He's professor of finance here at the University of Illinois in the College of Business. He's also co-director of the Office for Banking Research. He is a research associate at the Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland and the program coordinator for deposit insurance at the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation's Center for Financial Research. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you.